This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 5th, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ada Bogado. Fears ignited by the Indonesian military buildup in West Papua. The Pentagon continues to push plans to detonate a controversial 700-ton bomb test in Nevada. And groups pressure Congress to implement electronic voting machine protections. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. At least 10 people died in northern Sri Lanka today when Air Force jets bombed an alleged Tamil Tiger naval base in the fourth consecutive day of airstrikes. A new wave of violence has been escalating despite UN calls for an end to the fighting in the island nation. Panea Monica Vasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
An explosion on a passenger bus killed at least 5 passengers and wounded 35 others this evening near the Sri Lankan capital Colombo. This morning, a roadside bomb blast killed 2 Agriculture Department officials and wounded 2 others in the rebel-held territory near the northern town of Vavuniya. A policeman and 2 civilians were killed in separate incidents that took place elsewhere in the north. The government and the rebels traded accusations against each other for these attacks. Meanwhile, military officials claimed the Air Force destroyed a rebel naval base in the north during the fourth consecutive day of air raids. The rebels said the government bombs hit a settlement of people displaced by the 2004 tsunami. They say that the air raid wounded 5 civilians and warned of repercussions. A Norwegian brokered 2002 truce has all but disintegrated. Officials estimate that more than 3,600 fighters and civilians have been killed in renewed fighting in the past year. However, the ceasefire still officially holds on paper. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiah Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Late last year, Britain's Attorney General announced a decision to halt the Serious Fraud Office investigation into corruption allegations against British defense contractor BAE Systems and Saudi Arabia. But now the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is demanding an explanation. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Tony Blair threw his personal weight behind the controversial decision to halt the 2-year investigation.
Leave aside the effect on thousands of British jobs and billions worth of pounds for British industry. Our relationship with Saudi Arabia is vitally important for our country.
The problem is that Britain was one of 36 signatories to the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development's 1997 Convention on Bribery. Article 5 of that convention says that investigation and prosecution of the bribery of a foreign official cannot be influenced by considerations of national economic interest, the potential effect upon relations with another state, or the identity of the natural or legal persons involved. Now, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, or the OECD, wants to know more to see whether or not Britain has breached the convention. Britain's Attorney General will meet with the OECD's anti-bribery group in Paris later this month. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration has come out in defense of a signing statement issued last month that allows for the opening of sealed mail without a warrant. The president attached the signing statement to a postal reform bill that actually reinforced privacy laws regarding first-class mail. Laws are already in place that permit authorities to open packages thought to contain hazardous materials or explosive devices without a warrant. And special intelligence courts are able to issue warrants to search mail thought to contain criminal communications. The president issued the signing statement during the congressional recess. The ACLU has said it will file a Freedom of Information request in the coming days to find out more specific information on the policy. In Peru, 8 small farmers, or campesinos, were sent to a maximum security prison today on terrorism charges. Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
Shortly after assuming the presidency, Alan Garcia vowed to crack down on armed insurgency groups in Peru. One highly irregular case is that of 8 campesinos who were sent to a maximum security prison today. Last month, an identified gunman attacked an anti-drug squadron in a rural province in southeastern Peru. The ambush left 5 police officers and 3 civilians dead. 2 days later, 8 campesinos were detained and charged with possession of illegal firearms. The campesinos say they were not informed of their charges, did not have an attorney, and were not allowed to make declarations in Quechua, their native language. Forensic tests showed that none of the 8 accused had any gunpowder remains on their skin. The campesinos remain in prison because terror suspects in Peru are presumed guilty until proven innocent. President Alan Garcia has requested the application of the death penalty for those responsible of the ambush and has accused the campesinos of membership in the Shining Path guerrilla organization. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros in Lima, Peru.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
As part of their ethics and rules package, which passed Congress today, lawmakers installed PAYGO. It's a fiscal policy in which they'll spend only the money they have in the bank. As Leanne Caldwell reports, fiscal rigidness is expected for entitlement programs, but questions remain on how strict Democrats will be with the budget for the war.
The fiscally conservative Democrats, also known as Blue Dog Democrats, praised the passage of PAYGO, calling it a return to fiscal responsibility. But Representative Jane Harman, Democrat of California, says it's going to be difficult.
PAYGO will not be easy. Congress is a recovering alcoholic. And I think at the beginning of every debate, we're going to have to say, hi, I'm Congress and I'm a recovering alcoholic. And then try very hard to live up to that addiction.
The pay-as-you-go program passed the House Friday. It applies to mandatory spending such as Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. Mandatory spending comprised about $1.3 trillion of the budget, or about 54% last year. Although this PAYGO program does not include the defense portion of the budget nor the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It does, however, bring up the question of how the Democrats, with their mantra of fiscal responsibility, plan to address war funding. The Blue Dog Democrats, who are very influential in the Democratic Party, say they will continue to support the troops. Representative Alan Boyd, Democrat of Florida, a Blue Dog co-chair.
Let's not be under any illusion. What they have left us with their supplemental budgeting appropriating over the last several years is a complete fiscal mess that we have to straighten out.
So far, nearly $500 billion have been spent on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. The president is expected to ask for an additional $100 billion supplemental in the next couple of months. Representative Neil Abercrombie, Democrat of Hawaii, a proponent of bringing the troops home, says fiscally responsible policies must include the war.
When this discussion about paying as you go came up, I indicated to our caucus and to our leadership in the Democratic side and expenditure in the Pentagon side of the thing to pursue this, our version of imperialism, it just gets a pass. That's got to be brought into account too, or it's not going to work.
Next week, President Bush is expected to reveal his new plan for Iraq. He met with a group of moderate to conservative senators in the Democratic Party today to present them with options. It is being reported that he's going to announce a troop surge for Baghdad. In a sign of a new policy shift, Bush has named 2 new top commanders in Iraq. Joe Spratt of South Carolina, new chair of the Budget Committee, says he would like to know the cost estimates of each idea.
It would be good and useful for the purposes of debate and consideration of what we do if we had a reliable price tag projected over time connected with each of those scenarios.
Spratt says he will hold hearings on the $100 billion war supplemental, something that has not been done since the war began. Meanwhile, Representative Abercrombie is hoping that funding will be cut, not for the troops, but for the policy that keeps the troops engaged in Iraq.
The way you deal with that is if you want to end that, you fence the money off, you reprogram the money, you don't fund the redeployment, the fiscal requirements for redeploying troops into the area, all of that.
Abercrombie and several other Democrats have suggested they could severely limit the president's use of the military through the funding process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
More evidence has surfaced that strong systems are not in place to protect votes cast on electronic voting machines. The New York Times reported Thursday that the Federal Election Assistance Commission discovered this summer that the private firm responsible for testing machines hadn't been following quality control measures. And, as Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C., there's growing pressure on Congress to reform electronic voting machines and voter verification.
Will your vote count? That was the question asked this morning at a forum held by People for the American Way, the NAACP, and several other groups. Not if the last election is any indication, says Courtney Strickland-Bhatia with the Verified Voting Foundation.
The list of problems that occurred all over the country and with all different voting systems is extremely long.
One of the most dramatic examples is the 18,000 unrecorded votes in Florida, which led to the disputed election in the 13th Congressional District. Even before this problem in November, voters in that county wanted improvements to electronic voting machines, says Kendra Muntz with the Sarasota Alliance for Fair Elections.
It's only ironic that we also passed a county charter amendment the same day in which the voters want to have a voter-verified paper ballot and mandatory random independent audits of election results, because that is what people want in most of Florida and more around the country. They don't want a paper receipt. They don't want printers attached to touchscreen machines. They want a hard ballot to audit. And if audits are done, which is the key thing, then we have a hope of having elections that can be verified.
It is not yet known if the newly appointed Secretary of State Kurt Browning will appeal the ballot initiative filed in court by Florida's outgoing Secretary of State Sue Cobb. While there has been a big push for a paper trail across the U.S., there has not been enough attention on requiring audits of the paper ballots, concludes Lawrence Norden from the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's law school.
Although we have 27 states that mandate voter-verified paper records of some sort and another, there are maybe a dozen that mandate audits of the paper records. And without that, I'm not sure how much use the paper records are. If nobody's looking at them to make sure that the totals you're getting are correct, having them there, it might make voters feel better, but doesn't necessarily add any extra security.
Verifiable voting systems that are accessible to people with disabilities is also a shortcoming. Noelle Runyon, who has designed voting hardware for people with visual and hearing impairments, does not expect this problem to be remedied before the 2008 presidential election, unless disability rights activists take on the issue or the government funds it as a priority.
Trying to get accessible systems that have paper trails on them is even a much bigger challenge. And people seem to be really missing the fact that if they're just leaving it to the vendors to come up with some sort of an accessibility interface on a paper roll printer, that can in no way happen in this kind of time frame.
When Thomas Ricks, a staff person on the House Committee on Administration, now under the control of California Democrat Juanita Millender McDonald, cautioned dramatically changing the system before the 2008 election, he sparked strong disagreement from grassroots election reformer Kendra Muntz.
I don't think we can wait until 2010 to resolve this. I don't think we can go through a 2008 election with what we have now. I don't think that people will stand for it.
While the House may hold hearings on what happened in Florida and seek funding for training college students as poll workers, it is not clear if they will tackle the issue of how to create independent testing labs, which at this point are funded by the voting machine manufacturers. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Tensions continue in Somalia, where government forces and Ethiopian troops have been fighting the Union of Islamic Courts, which the Bush administration says is linked to Al-Qaeda. The U.S. Navy is deployed off the coast of Somalia, and the U.S. State Department announced Thursday they were sending several million dollars worth of humanitarian aid to the country. Meanwhile, the transitional federal government of Somalia fully extended its control over the south and center of the country, including the capital. As Abdurrahman Warsami reports from Mogadishu, the real task of governing the country has just begun.
In the effort to stabilize a chaotic country, both the Somali president and the prime minister have been attempting to gain control over a country where former warlords and freelance gunmen have grown in number. The Somali president is currently in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, holding talks with regional and international partners to send a peacekeeping force to his country. But so far, only Uganda has reluctantly offered to send a contingent. In the Somali capital of Mogadishu, Ali Gedi, prime minister of the interim Somali government, on Monday asked faction leaders and local residents to surrender their weapons within 3 days, or the weapons would be collected by force. As of the Thursday deadline, just a handful of people in Mogadishu handed in small arms, a tiny fraction of the weapons in the capital. According to Mogadishu peace campaigner Yusuf Ali, the disarmament needed more careful planning.
As we know, Mogadishu is very complex and is a city, which inhabited by very varying clans. Each wants to be very careful with the other. And the disarmament is good, and everyone appreciates that Mogadishu is disarmed. But I would say, you know, the Prime Minister should come up with a verifiable strategy which will make every clan inclusive to the government. And, you know, the disarmament plan should be also set by committees, you know, maybe elected by the Prime Minister or the President.
The government, which was formed in 2004 in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, after marathon talks between warring factions in Somalia, did not set foot in the capital but was confined first in Joha, a town 90 kilometers north of the Somali capital. But after the president fell out with the governor, the government then had to move to Baidoa, 250 kilometers southwest of Mogadishu, where it remained for the past year and a half. During that time, an Islamist group called the Union of Islamic Courts swept to power, forcing out an alliance of Mogadishu warlords and establishing a semblance of law and order in the capital and most of the southern and central region of the country. Marian Abdullah, a businesswoman in the Somali capital, says the government needs to do a lot to win the hearts and minds of the people.
The government has used Ethiopian troops to come to the capital, and that is not what we support. But if they change their ways and bring peace and stability, like the Islamic courts did, we can support them. But if what we see now, robbery and carjacking in broad daylight, and all the bad things that the courts eradicated, if that continues, they will never succeed in governing and will go back to their hole in Baidoa.
That seems to be the challenge for the government. A broad skepticism among the Somali people was heightened by the recent pronouncement by the Deputy Prime Minister Hussein Aidid that both Somalia and its western neighbor Ethiopia could have a unified currency, passport, and ultimately political union. Reporting for FSRN, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
Despite growing opposition from the public, the Pentagon continues to push their plans to detonate the 700-ton Divine Strike bomb test in Nevada. The blast is expected to be 50 times larger than the biggest weapon in the U.S. arsenal. The Pentagon is holding public meetings next week in Las Vegas and Salt Lake City, but opponents have called the meetings nothing but propaganda. Joining me on the line is Mary Dixon, a founder of Downwinder United, a group fighting to end all testing at the Nevada nuclear test site and elsewhere. Mary Dixon, what are the possible health and environmental threats from the Divine Strike test?
Well, the real concern from this is that, as you know, there were 928 nuclear tests conducted at the Nevada test site. So the big fear is that radionuclides, long-living radionuclides left over from those blasts, will be sucked up into that debris and dispersed into the atmosphere, which is something that is absolutely not acceptable for downwind populations.
Now, historically, the government has performed tests in this region. Have you personally been affected by past government bomb tests?
Oh, most definitely. I suffered from thyroid cancer. My sister died of lupus. In the neighborhood I grew up in Salt Lake City, we have counted in a 5-block area at least 45 people who got various cancers or autoimmune diseases, which we are guessing are due to testing.
Now, this is a non-nuclear test, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Does this in any way violate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
That's an interesting question because it's non-nuclear. That's how it kind of got slipped in. It also got slipped in. It's interesting because the Congress last year had said that they would not allow any testing of these small-yield nuclear devices. And so the way this kind of gets sneaked in is to say, well, it's not a nuclear device. But if you're looking at this, there's kind of a contradiction here because the Defense Department has said that Divine Strike is designed to identify the smallest nuclear yield possible to destroy underground targets. So if they're looking at this as a precursor to the development of some sort of new nuclear weapons, this is a major problem and a huge concern for downwinders as well and for the rest of the country.
You mentioned the public hearings. The Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency is holding a series of meetings on the blast next week. What's problematic about these meetings?
Okay, we are really skeptical of these tests. You know, the feds promised hearings in Utah, Nevada, and Arizona. They've got some hearings scheduled for Utah and Nevada, but these are not public hearings in the traditional sense. These are basically information sessions where they will have representatives from the Department of Energy and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency on hand to answer technical questions about the test, and they'll be displaying posters with information about the test. But there is not an opportunity for public citizens to make their concerns heard. Once again, we're seeing the tactics that were used during the years of nuclear testing, where we're being asked to trust the government and its scientific experts' plans to explode bombs in the desert. But those scientists have been wrong before. We are asking our elected representatives to demand legitimate hearings.
Mary Dixon is a downwinder living in Salt Lake City. She said her group and others may boycott the Pentagon's meetings and protest instead. The meetings are scheduled for January 9th in Las Vegas, January 10th in Salt Lake City, and January 11th in St. George, Utah. Lieutenant Aaron Watada faced a military judge during the pretrial hearing phase of his court-martial Thursday at Fort Lewis near Seattle. Lieutenant Watada is charged with refusing to deploy with his unit to Iraq and with behavior unbecoming of an officer for speaking at a Veterans for Peace convention. He is also being prosecuted for making contemptuous statements when he told journalists that the Bush administration used lies to justify the war in Iraq. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
Watada's attorney, Eric Seitz, argued in the military court proceedings that the secondary charges filed against Watada should be dropped since they amount to prosecution for political speech.
He was raising controversial issues, and he was stating his own opinions on those controversial issues. And we believe it's absolutely impermissible in the military or outside the military to punish people for being engaged in that kind of speech.
Watada's legal team has requested a separate hearing to argue the illegality of the war in Iraq. Referred to as the Nuremberg defense, Seitz will argue that Watada refused to deploy to Iraq because doing so would have been participation in an illegal war.
The comments basically have been directed toward criticizing the way in which we went to war, the deceptions that were perpetrated on the American people and the Congress. He didn't intend to be disrespectful or disloyal. In fact, he regards his actions and the remarks that he's made as being an act of loyalty.
The judge, Lieutenant Colonel John Head, is expected to rule on whether to allow the defense to present evidence that the war is illegal within the next 2 weeks. Seitz admits that it will be very difficult to fight the Army's charges against Watada for his refusal to redeploy to Iraq with the 3rd Striker Brigade stationed at Fort Lewis. He hopes to convince the court to reduce Watada's potential 6-year sentence.
Our chances of winning, of getting an acquittal, are probably not very good. Our chances of getting an acceptable outcome, which hopefully means that Lieutenant Watada doesn't go to prison for a long period of time, are something that we are very optimistic about.
Military prosecutors declined to be interviewed. The next phase of the court proceedings will take place February 5th through the 9th. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
There are alarming reports of a buildup of the Indonesian military and police forces in the Puncak Jaya province of West Papua. This is in response to the deaths of 2 Indonesian military personnel in December, which are being blamed on independence forces. Erica Voles reports on West Papuans' mounting fears of reprisals.
Conflicting reports place the buildup of military and police personnel at between 800 and 3,000. Jonah Wender is a human rights activist with links to several civil society groups, as well as armed independence groups such as the OPM and TPN. He says that at least one battalion of Indonesian forces, known as TNI, has been sent into the region in response to the deaths of 2 soldiers and the raising of the West Papuan Morning Star flag, an act of defiance. Raising the flag has previously seen activists sentenced to up to 15 years in jail.
This caused the Indonesian government to send more troops out to the Puncak Jaya. The War Memorial is sending one battalion. It's about 800 people, 800 troops.
But the spokesperson for the Indonesian embassy in Australia, Dino Kusnadi, has denied that an operation involving large numbers of military personnel is underway in the Puncak Jaya region. He insists any extra personnel are largely police, numbering up to 700, who have been sent in to hunt for the murderers of the 2 Indonesian military officers.
The fact of the matter is that there is a case of law and order to uphold, and that these people, the perpetrators who have murdered the 2 military people have gone to the hills and hid themselves among the local communities.
Rights activist Jonah Wender maintains that both military and police personnel are going into the central region. He says the build-up of Indonesian personnel will prompt civilians to either flee the area to avoid interrogation or avoid leaving their homes, preventing them from hunting and gathering food.
During this operation, maybe the troublemaker is already hiding in a bush. The people who are living around that place will be targeted by the police or mobile squad for the questioning. Even they pass them, or you know, they use that kind of way to show the way where the people who are troublemaker are hiding.
However, the Indonesian embassy spokesperson Dino Kusnadi denies the civilian population has anything to fear from what he insists is a mainly police presence.
If there are military personnel involved, these are under the supervision of the police to assist the police in upholding law and order. It is the responsibility of the police to apprehend these people without inflicting any casualties or harm the civilians in that area.
Security analyst Clinton Fernandez says based on research he conducted whilst in West Papua, those who come into contact with Indonesian forces in the Puncak Jaya region have every reason to be fearful.
As the US State Department has also said, the military says targets basically anyone indiscriminately and suspects almost everybody of being a separatist. It treats anybody it arrests as de facto guilty of separatism and extracts confessions through torture.
The tensions in central West Papua come as the Australian Parliament gets ready to ratify a security pact between Indonesia and Australia. This agreement explicitly acknowledges Indonesia's territorial control over West Papua. Clinton Fernandez says whatever comes out of the current situation, the security pact will do nothing to rein in human rights violations in West Papua.
All the treaty does is provide the Indonesian military with diplomatic cover to act as it wishes.
Meanwhile, many in West Papua remain sceptical that the deaths of the Indonesian soldiers had anything to do with the separatist movement, which voted in 2006 to pursue peaceful dialogue over armed conflict with Indonesia. This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for FSRN.
Tilly Olson, feminist activist and writer, died this week at the age of 94.
For most of my life, I shared the common, shall I say, fate or common circumstances for those of my class, which is working class, and those of my sex, women. I bore and raised four children. Much of the time, I was the sole provider, and did other of the everyday work of the world. I do not accept that it's because of special blazing exercise of will that the artist is supposed to have that ordinary mortals do not. I know it took far more will, courage, everything else I could summon to get myself up what I had to do in the morning in order to get myself and the kids out of the house, to get to work, to get through the day's work, to get the shopping or the other things I needed to get done, sometimes to get to pick up a kid, to manage to get through dinner without screaming my head off. That took far more of a daily exercise of those qualities than it does in these last few years when I've been comparatively lucky and I'm able to go into a room of my own and close the door and climb walls with my work.
The voice of Tilly Olson, recorded in 1981, brought to us by the Pacifica Radio Archives. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Otto Bogato.